Chase naturally opposed Seabury Stanton's demand for modernization, but the new Berkshire Hathaway was governed by Stanton's sense of destiny. He simplified the product line, focusing on rayon, turning out more than half the men's suit linings in the United States. As Berkshire Hathaway under Stanton unreeled nearly a quarter billion yards of fabrics a year, he continued his relentless modernizing, pouring another $1 million into the mills. By this time, his brother Otis had begun to have doubts about the feasibility of remaining in New Bedford, but Seabury thought the time for a textile mill to move south had passed and refused to give up his dream of reviving the mills. When Dan Cohen approached Buffett about Berkshire in 1962, Buffett was already aware of it, just as he was of any U.S. business of a meaningful size. The money that poured into the company meant that Berkshire was worth, according to its accountants, $22 million as a business, or $19.46 per share. And yet, after 9 years of losses, anyone could acquire the stock for just $7.50. Buffett started buying it. Seabury had been buying Berkshire's stock as well, using extra cash that was not being poured back into the mills to make a tender offer for shares every couple of years. Buffett's theory was that Seabury would continue, and he could time his own transactions, buying whenever the stock got cheap and selling it back to the company whenever the price rose. He and Cohen set about buying stock. Had anyone known Buffett was buying, it might have pushed up the price, so he bought through Howard Brown of Tweedy Brown. The firm was a favorite broker of Buffett's because everyone there, especially Brown, was close-mouthed, of utmost importance to Buffett given his insistence on secrecy. Tweedy Brown had codenamed the Buffett Partnership's account BWX. When Buffett arrived at Tweedy Brown, which maintained a tiny office at 52 Wall Street, in the same Art Deco building where Ben Graham had once worked, it felt like entering an old-fashioned barber shop with its black-and-white ceramic tile floor. In a little office to the left sat the firm's secretary and office manager. To the right lay the trading room. Past that, in a small, rented alcove, half-filled with a water cooler and a coat rack, in effect a sort of closet, sat Walter Schloss, running his partnership from a battered desk. Using Graham's method without the slightest variation, he had been averaging returns of better than 20% a year since leaving Graham Newman. To pay his rent to Tweedy Brown in lieu of cash, he gave the firm commissions by trading stocks. His trades were few, and he was getting a great bargain on the rent. He limited his other expenses to the cost of a subscription to Value Line Investment Survey, some paper and pencils, subway tokens, and nothing else. Along the center of the trading room ran a 20-foot wooden table, which the firm had acquired somewhere on its way to a garbage dump. Its surface bore the marks of generations of schoolchildren armed with penknives. To write down figures, a tablet had to be placed underneath the paper, otherwise Todd Loves Mary would be embossed into the text. On one side of the child-scarred table, Howard Brown ruled with benign authority. He and his partners faced the firm's trader, who, like all traders, sat, jumpy and restless, waiting for the phone to ring so that he could trade. Next to him, an empty space at the table served as the visitor's desk. The cheapest of wooden filing cabinets lined the walls. Nowhere else in New York did Buffett feel so at home as sitting at the Tweedy Brown visitor's desk. The firm had branched out into arbitrage, workouts, all but completed turnaround situations where a little money remained to be made, and stubs, companies being acquired and broken up, all the sorts of things he liked. It traded securities, such as 15-year Jamaica Queens water warrants, rights to buy the water company's stock, which rose whenever there was speculation that New York City would someday take over the waterworks. They fell again when speculation lulled. Tweedy Brown bought them every time they dropped and sold them every time they rose, over and over and over again. The firm also made a specialty of fencing with the managements of these obscure, undervalued businesses, trying to force out hidden value, as with Sanborn Map. "We were always in court suing," one partner says. All of it reeked of the old Graham Newman days and bore little similarity to the gargantuan American Express deal, but Buffett loved the atmosphere. Tom Knapp researched stocks and spent his days plotting practical jokes when he wasn't orchestrating trades. He had commandeered a huge storage closet filling it with the 4-cent Blue Eagle stamps he and Buffett had made the mistake of buying and topographical maps of the Maine coastline. The pile of maps continually grew, for Knapp was funneling the cash he made from stocks into buying up the coast of Maine. The pile of Blue Eagles slowly shrank as Tweedy Brown pasted 40 stamps onto each batch of the pink sheets they sent to Buffett once a week, every week. The pink sheet quotations for stocks not listed on the New York Stock Exchange were stale the moment they went to print. Buffett used his pink sheets merely as a starting point for the telephonic bazaar in which calls to numerous brokers might be required to make a trade. He was a master at working this system through his brokers. The lack of a publicly posted price helped reduce competition. Someone who was willing to call every market maker and squeeze them mercilessly had a meaningful advantage over the less energetic or the more faint-hearted. Brown would call Buffett to let him know they had XYZ stock on offer at $5 a share. "4¾ bid," Buffett would say without hesitation. This maneuver, casting the line, would fish out how hungry the seller was. After calling the client to see if he would take a lower price, Brown would call Buffett with a response. "Sorry, can't take less than $5. "Unthinkable," Buffett would answer. A few days later, Brown would call Buffett again. "We got the stock at 4¾. We'll go along with 4¾ bid." "Sorry," Buffett would now say instantly. "4½ bid." Brown would go back to the seller, who would say, "What the hell? What happened to the 4¾? "We're just passing along the message. 4½ bid." More calls would go back and forth until a week later, Brown came back to Buffett. "Okay, 4½ bid," he'd say. "Sorry," Buffett would say, and drop it another eighth. 4⅜. Thus he buffeted the price ever lower, and rarely, almost never, did he want a stock badly enough to raise his bid. He placed his first order for Berkshire Hathaway through Tweedy on December 12, 1962, for 2,000 shares at $7.50 a share, paying the broker a $20 commission. He told Tweedy to keep buying. Cohen got the scuttlebutt on Berkshire from board member Stanley Rubin, Berkshire's top salesman, who happened to be a friend of Otis Stanton, another member of the board. Otis Stanton felt his brother was out of touch. Protected by his secretaries and his ivory tower, Seabury was doing more and more drinking as the clash between his lofty vision and reality worsened. Otis was by now sharply at odds with Seabury. He felt his brother should have taken a strike rather than giving in to demands for higher wages. He also disapproved of Seabury's choice of a successor, his son Jack, who was a pleasant enough young man, but not up to the job, according to Otis. Otis had his own idea about who should succeed Seabury, Ken Chase, the vice president of manufacturing. Seabury Stanton responded to Buffett's purchases as though a takeover threat was imminent and made several tender offers for the stock. This was exactly what Buffett wanted, for his purchases were predicated on the theory that eventually Seabury would buy him out. He wanted the Berkshire stock not to keep it, but to sell it. Nevertheless, in every trade, there is a buyer and a seller. Seabury Stanton had so far withstood the forces of cheap foreign fabric and Hurricane Carol. Instead of Seabury getting buffeted, there was a chance that Buffett could get seaburied. Eventually, Warren drove up to New Bedford to see the place for himself. For once, he was not just dropping in. Miss Tabor, who was fiercely loyal to Seabury, decided which callers would be allowed through the glass doors and up the narrow stairs to Stanton's penthouse office. When she grimly ushered Warren into Stanton's palatially furnished, ballroom-size wood-paneled lair, he saw that there was no place anywhere near Stanton's desk to sit. This clearly was a man used to summoning people to stand before him while he sat behind his desk and directed them what to do. The two men seated themselves at the uncomfortable rectangular glass conference table in a corner, and Buffett asked where Stanton stood on the next tender offer. Stanton looked at him through the wire-rimmed glasses perched on the tip of his nose. He was reasonably cordial, but then he said, "We'll probably have a tender one of these days, and what price would you sell at, Mr. Buffett?" or words to that effect. The stock at the time was selling at something like $9 or $10 a share. I said I'd sell at $11.50 a share on a tender offer, if they had one. And he said, "Well, will you promise me that if we have a tender offer, you'll tender?" I said, Well, you know, if it's in the reasonably near future, but not if it's 20 years from now. But I said fine. So now I was frozen. I felt that I couldn't buy any more stock because I knew too much about what he might do. So I went home, and not too long after, a letter comes from the old Colony Trust Company, which was part of First National of Boston, offering 11 3/8 per share to anyone who would tender their Berkshire. That was 12.5 cents less per share than agreed. Buffett was furious. It really burned me up. You know, this guy was trying to chisel an eighth of a point from having, in effect, shaken my hand saying this was the deal. Warren was used to doing the buffeting, and now Stanton had tried to chisel him. He sent Dan Cohen to New Bedford to try to reason with Stanton not to renege on the deal. The two men argued, and Stanton denied that he had made a deal with Buffett. He told Cohen that it was his company, and he would do as he pleased. That was a mistake. For trying to chisel Warren Buffett, Seabury Stanton was going to be sorry, very sorry. Buffett decided that, instead of selling, now he would buy. He vowed that he would have Berkshire. He would buy it all. He would own it, lock, stock, loom, and spindle. That Berkshire Hathaway was a failing, futile enterprise daunted him not. It was cheap, and he craved it. Above all, he wanted Seabury Stanton not to have it. Buffett and the other shareholders deserved it more. In his determination, he ignored all the lessons learned from the experience at Dempster, save one. And that was the one he should have ignored. Buffett sent his scouts out, looking for more chunks of the closely held stock. Cohen got hold of enough to join Berkshire's board, but other people began to take notice, too. Jack Alexander, Buffett's old friend from Columbia, had an investment partnership with his classmate Buddy Fox. One day we saw that Warren was buying this Berkshire Hathaway, he says, and we started to buy. On a trip to New York from their office in Connecticut, they told him they were following him in the stock. He got very upset. Look, he said, you're riding on my coattails. That's not right. Cut it out. Fox and Alexander were taken aback. What were they doing wrong? Buffett gave them to understand that he was seeking control, yet coattail riding, even in control situations, was a popular pastime among the Graham crowd. It was considered sporting conduct. In effect, Buffett took their stock. I need it more than you, he said. They agreed to sell their stock to him at the then market price because it clearly mattered to him so much. He appeared to have some sort of mysterious attachment to Berkshire Hathaway. It wasn't that important to us. It was obviously very important to him, Alexander says. Like Fox and Alexander, a few others had also become Buffett watchers, tracking Warren's trail like the spore of Bigfoot. This created competition for the stock. He made it understood among the Grahamites that they were to keep their mitts off Berkshire. The only exception was Henry Brandt. He let Brandt, in recompense for his services, buy it below $8. He had begun to carry himself with a bit of swagger, which some people found irritating. Yet his sure-footedness, the way he always seemed to be so right, kept them fascinated. Even his cheapskate qualities were part of the aura. For years, he had been possibly the only person doing business regularly in New York who managed to get by with not only free lodging, by staying with Fred Culkin's mother, Anne Gottschalk, on Long Island, but free office space to boot at Tweedy Brown. Now that Susie accompanied him on some of these trips, however, at her behest he had upgraded from hosteling with his deceased college friend's mother to taking a room at the Plaza Hotel. Not only was the Plaza more convenient for business, but from Susie's perspective, it put department stores like Bergdorf Goodman, Best & Company, and Henry Bendel close at hand. Then a rumor circulated among Buffett's friends, the kinds of rumors that always swirled around Buffett, like the one that had him stashing his daughter in a dresser drawer rather than buying her a crib, a rumor that he had found the Plaza's cheapest room, a tiny windowless cubicle like his old maid's room at Columbia, and cut a deal to stay there at a beggarly price whenever he came alone to New York. Regardless of the rumor's truth, each time he checked into the Plaza, he doubtless felt a pang of regret, for he no longer stayed in New York scot-free. The trips to Bergdorf's were another aspect of how much the New York routine had changed. Susie spent her days going to lunch and shopping. In the evenings, they went to dinner, then Broadway or cabaret shows. He liked to see her enjoy herself, and she had become used to shopping at the better stores. Nevertheless, while she now had the power to loosen the purse strings, their game was to tussle over how much money she got to spend. Her way of justifying spending was to do it on someone else's behalf. Susie Jr. was often a beneficiary, her closets filled with clothes from Bergdorf's. One time Susie came back from New York with an ermine jacket. They had met a friend of Warren's who took them to a furrier. "I felt like I had to buy something," she said. "They were being so nice to me." She had done it for the furrier's sake. Now, all this protecting Berkshire from coattailing would be for naught unless Buffett figured out how to run it well enough to keep Susie in ermine jackets. He made another visit to New Bedford, going by the mill to see Jack Stanton, the heir apparent. Somebody was going to have to run the place once it was wrested from Seabury's hands, and Warren needed to know who that would be. But Stanton claimed to be very busy and sent Ken Chase to escort Buffett around the mill. No relation to Malcolm Chase, who had become chairman of the board when Berkshire Fine Spinning merged with Hathaway Manufacturing. Stanton had no idea that his uncle had already suggested Chase as a possible replacement for Seabury. Ken Chase was a chemical engineer by training, 47, quiet, controlled, and sincere. He did not know that he was a contender to run the company. Nonetheless, he spent 2 days teaching Buffett the textile business while Buffett asked question after question and Chase explained the mill's problems. Buffett was impressed by his candor and equally impressed by his attitude. Chase made it clear that he thought the Stantons foolish for pouring money into a business that was on its way down the drain. When the tour was over, Buffett told Chase he would be in touch. A month or so later, Stanley Rubin had to be called into service to persuade Chase not to take a job at a competing textile mill. Meanwhile, Buffett was scrambling to buy more stock, including shares that belonged to various members of the Chase family. Buffett's final target was Otis Stanton, who wanted his brother to retire. He had no confidence in Seabury's son Jack, and doubted Seabury would ever let go of the reins. Otis and his wife Mary agreed to meet Buffett at the Wamsutta Club in New Bedford. Over lunch at the graceful Italianate mansion, a relic of New Bedford's one-time grandeur, Otis acknowledged that he would sell on the condition that Buffett would make an equivalent offer to Seabury. Warren agreed. Then Mary Stanton asked if they could keep just a couple of shares out of the 2,000 they were selling, out of family sentiment. Just a couple of shares. Buffett said no. It was all or nothing. Otis Stanton's 2,000 shares pushed Warren's ownership to 49% of Berkshire Hathaway, enough to give him effective control. With the prize within his grasp, he met Ken Chase one April afternoon in New York and walked him out to the teeming plaza at Fifth Avenue in Central Park South, where he sprang for 2 bars of ice cream on a stick. Within a bite or two, he got to the point, saying, "Ken, I'd like to have you become president of Berkshire Hathaway. How do you feel about that?" Now that he controlled the company, he said, he could change the management at the next director's meeting. Chase, who was stunned to be selected despite the hints Rubin had given him when he convinced him not to take another job, agreed to keep quiet until the board meeting. Not realizing that his fate had been decided, Jack Stanton and his wife raced down from New Bedford to meet Warren and Susie at the Plaza Hotel for breakfast. Kitty Stanton, more aggressive than her husband, pled Jack's case. Reaching for an argument that would appeal to the Buffetts, Kitty threw in what she must have thought was the clincher. Buffett surely would not overturn New England's hereditary mill aristocracy, who had overseen the business for generations, to put a mill rat like Ken Chase in charge. She and Jack fit in at the Wamsutta Club. Kitty, after all, was a junior leaguer, like Susie. She was a nice enough person, but I also got the impression that she felt Jack was entitled to it because of his dad. Part of her appeal was that Ken Chase really wasn't in the same class as Jack Stanton, and she and Susie and I were. Poor Kitty, making this pitch to a man who so disdained hierarchy that he had refused to join Exarban and thumbed his nose at the establishment of Omaha. It was too late for Jack. It was too late for Seabury, who ruled by autocracy and had no friends on the board. Even his own chairman, Malcolm Chase, did not like him. Thus, when backers of Buffett arranged for him to be nominated to the board at a special meeting on April 14, 1965, he was swiftly elected a director with much of the board's support. A few weeks later, Buffett flew into New Bedford, where he was greeted by a headline in the New Bedford Standard Times about outside interests taking over the company. The planted story infuriated him. The one lesson that had stuck with him from Dempster was to never, ever let himself be branded a liquidator and wind up with a whole town hating him. Buffett vowed to the press that he would carry on business as usual. He denied that mill closings would result from the takeover and saddled himself publicly with this commitment. On May 10, 1965, the board convened at Berkshire's headquarters in New Bedford. It presented a silver tray to the retiring vice president of sales, approved the minutes of the last meeting, and agreed to increase wages 5%. Then the meeting turned surreal. Seabury, his nearly bald 70-year-old head speckled with age spots, claimed that he had planned to retire in December to let Jack succeed him. But, he said, he could not continue as president of an organization over which he would not have complete authority. With as much hauteur as his character allowed him, which was considerable, despite the mutineers having taken over the ship, Seabury made a little speech, commending himself for his accomplishments. Then he tendered his resignation, and the board accepted it. Jack Stanton added a bitter little coda, saying that, had he become president in December, he was certain that it would have meant continued success and profitable operations. The board listened patiently, then accepted his resignation as well. At that point, Jack Stanton put down his pen and stopped taking the minutes in which these two speeches had been recorded, and the two Stantons stalked out of the room. The board paused and sighed with relief. Moving quickly on, the board elected Buffett chairman and confirmed Ken Chase in his new job running the doomed company that Buffett, in a moment of folly, had exerted such strenuous effort to acquire. A few days later, he explained his thinking on textiles in a newspaper interview. "We're neither pro nor con. It's a business decision. We try to assess a business. Price is the big factor in investment. It determines the decision. We bought Berkshire Hathaway at a good price." He would later come to revise that opinion. "So I bought my own cigar butt, and I tried to smoke it. You walk down the street, and you see a cigar butt, and it's kind of soggy and disgusting and repels you, but it's free, and there may be one puff left in it. Berkshire didn't have any more puffs, so all you had was a soggy cigar butt in your mouth. That was Berkshire Hathaway in 1965. I had a lot of money tied up in the cigar butt. I would have been better off if I'd never heard of Berkshire Hathaway." Chapter 28. Dry Tinder. Omaha, 1965 to 1966. "The dynamics changed 100% when my father died," says Doris. "Everything went flying into space. My father was the linchpin of our family. The center was gone." Lila had endured multiple losses over recent years. Her mother, Stella, had died in 1960 in Norfolk State Hospital, and her sister Bernice had died a year later of bone cancer. Without Howard, she had to find a new sense of purpose, and she became dependent on Warren and Susie and their family. The grandchildren went to her house on Sundays, where she gave them bags of candy to eat during church, then took them to lunch afterward and gave them money if they could add up the bill correctly. In the afternoons, she took them to Woolworth's to buy a toy to play with at her house. Like Howard, who had once paid his children to go to church, she found a Buffettesque solution to the problem of her loneliness, making deals with the grandchildren so that they would stay with her as long as possible. Howard's presence was what had always made being with Lila tolerable to Doris and Warren. Without him, both found visits with their mother unbearable. Warren trembled when forced to be in proximity to her. At Thanksgiving, he took a plate, went upstairs, and ate dinner by himself. Lila continued to erupt in occasional fits of rage. For decades, her bizarre behavior had been aimed only at family members, though once she leaped out of the car in a parking lot and spent an hour screaming at an acquaintance over some trivial matter as Big Susie and Howie looked on in astonishment. But Doris, who had idolized her father even more than her brother had, was still her main victim. Doris had always felt she had let the whole family down with her divorce from Truman. The contrast between Warren and Susie's successes and her own life as a divorcee at a time when divorce was still rare only reinforced her lingering feelings of worthlessness. Shortly before his death, Howard had told her that she must remarry to provide a father for her children. So she did, to George Lear, the first person who asked her. He was a lovable man, but Doris felt coerced into remarrying, which augured poorly for the union's prospects. Bertie, always the least troubled by her mother's behavior and the least dependent on her father, now found her life the least changed by her father's death. Like Warren, however, her relationship with money both triggered her anxieties and gave her a sense of control. She kept records of every dollar she spent, and when she felt stressed, she paid bills to relax. All of the Buffetts had issues with money that ran so deep none of them really noticed what an unusual family they were. After Howard's death, Warren and Susie naturally assumed leadership of the family, partly because of their money, but also through the force of their personalities. Lila and Doris and Bertie looked to Warren and Susie for support, and so did virtually everyone else. Warren's uncle Fred Buffett and his wife Katie, who now owned the grocery store, gave Warren a run for his money in the family's cheapskate contest. They were especially attached to Warren and Susie, and grew more so as their nephew's stature and wealth increased. Lila, who had always been jealous of her sister-in-law, fixated on an incident many years before in which Ernest had danced with the vivacious Katie and not her at a Rotary Club dance. Now she grew even more jealous of Katie, and Susie, who was trusted by everyone, had to juggle visits to separate them. Given all the work to separate Lila from Warren and from Katie, Susie was an expert juggler by the time she had nursed Howard through his final illness. Perhaps it was not surprising, therefore, that Warren's Aunt Alice, his favorite relative since childhood, had grown to trust Susie more than anyone else in the family except him. So it was Susie, not Lila, whom Alice tracked down one Monday in late 1965. Susie was at the beauty parlor with Doris when the call came. She got out from under the dryer to go to the phone at the front desk. Alice explained that she was concerned about Lila's sister Edie, who had called her on Sunday to say she was feeling extremely depressed. Alice, a fellow teacher, had taken Edie for a drive and talked to her, and they had stopped for ice cream. Edie idolized Warren and Susie and Alice, indeed all the Buffetts. She confided that she felt she had disgraced the perfect family with her imperfect life. Her impulsive, high-spirited marriage had not worked out. The husband she had followed to Brazil had turned out to be a philandering embezzler who left her there for someone else. Since returning from Brazil, she had found it hard adjusting to life as a divorced single mother of two daughters in Omaha. Alice told Susie that today Edie hadn't shown up at technical high school to teach her home economics classes. Worried, Alice had gone over to Edie's apartment. Nobody answered when she rang and knocked. Alice told Susie that she feared that something had happened. So Susie raced out the door to her gold Cadillac convertible, with her rollers still in her hair, drove over to the garage apartment where Edie lived, and started knocking and ringing herself. When nobody answered, she got inside somehow and began to search. She found no sign of anybody. The place was immaculate. There were no notes or messages, and Edie's car was there. Susie continued searching until she reached the basement of the house, and there she found Edie. She had slit her wrists and was already dead. Susie called an ambulance, then had to break the news to the family. No one had known that Edie was this depressed, and nobody had seriously considered her a possible victim of the Stahl family's history of mental instability until now. Those whom Edie had left behind worked through a complex web of feelings. Guilt that she had been so desperate without their realizing it. Pity that she may have seen herself as so inferior to the Buffetts. Grief at the loss. Warren, Doris, and Bertie were shaken and sad at the loss of a kind, loving aunt whom they had been extremely fond of since childhood. There is no telling what Lila, 62 years old, felt at her sister's death. But why should Lila, who always did feel put upon, feel any different than other survivors of those who commit suicide, who normally experience anger and abandonment, along with other emotions? At the very least, Edie's death meant that Lila was the last remaining member of her immediate family. Edie had also taken away the opportunity to repair their strained relationship. And yet another of the Stahls had embarrassed the Buffetts, this time by stigmatizing the family with suicide. Whatever Lila did feel, less than a month later, she abruptly married Roy Ralph, a pleasant man, 20 years her senior, who had been pursuing her since Howard's death. Until now, she had refused his proposals. Her relatives had listened with numb boredom throughout her widowhood as she ceaselessly invoked the past and the 38 and a half wonderful years with Howard. Thus, she stunned them all when she reversed herself and changed her name to Lila Ralph. Some of them thought she was out of her mind, and conceivably she was, at least temporarily. Howard, who had remained an invisible but constant presence since his death less than 2 years before, now went unmentioned at family gatherings for the sake of politeness, while his children adapted uneasily to a new stepfather who was in his 80s. Susie, meanwhile, was taking on more obligations than ever, not just in the family, but in the community. She began to press Warren to call a halt to his continuing obsession. The Buffett partnership was stuffed like a Thanksgiving turkey by American Express. It ended 1965 with assets of $37 million, including more than $3.5 million in profit on this one stock, which had risen to $50, then $60, then $70 per share. Warren had earned more than $2.5 million in fees, bringing his and Susie's stake in the partnership to $6.8 million. He was 35 years old. The Buffetts were among the very rich by the standards of 1966. How much money did they need? How long did he have to keep going at this pace? Now that they were so rich, Susie thought they should do more for Omaha. In 1966, she glowed with the fire of a woman who had found her cause in life. She had become close to leaders of the black community and was all over Omaha, brainstorming, coordinating, cajoling, publicizing, working on behind-the-scenes relationships in a town where racial tensions were reaching the point of violence. Every summer now in the nation's major cities, race riots flared after minor incidents involving the police. Martin Luther King Jr. had issued a call the previous year, desegregating workplaces and public facilities wasn't enough. Segregated housing had to be eliminated. The idea terrified many whites, especially after riots in the Watts neighborhood of Los Angeles, which had turned into a war zone of arson, sniping, and looting, in which 34 people were killed. Similar uprisings had taken place in Cleveland, Chicago, Brooklyn, Jacksonville, Florida, and other smaller towns. During a 15-day heat wave in July 1966, riots erupted in Omaha. The governor called out the National Guard, blaming the riots on an environment unfit for human habitation. Susie now made the elimination of segregated housing in Omaha her central cause. She tried to involve Warren in some of her community and civil rights work, and he complied, but he was not much for committees. In the 1960s, Buffett generally rolled over sapheads without even commenting. "I got involved in half a dozen of these things. It's just the nature of it. If people focus their whole lives on one thing, they get a little obsessed after a while, and Susie would always see it coming with me. I would be sitting with these guys, and she would see that look on my face as they went off into the wild blue yonder." Committee meetings also gave him a splitting headache, according to Munger. His way, therefore, was to let other people sit on the committees while he fed them ideas. Warren was far from indifferent to social and political causes, however. He had become deeply concerned about the potential for nuclear war, a vivid and seemingly impending threat in the early 1960s, since President Kennedy had urged families to build fallout shelters in order to survive a nuclear attack, and the United States had barely averted a nuclear war after a standoff between Kennedy and Khrushchev over the removal of Soviet missiles from Cuba. When Buffett discovered philosopher Bertrand Russell's 1962 anti-nuclear treatise, Has Man a Future?, it affected him powerfully. He identified with Russell, admired his philosophical rigor, and frequently cited his opinions and aphorisms. He even kept a small plaque on his desk quoting a phrase from an influential anti-nuclear manifesto on which Russell had collaborated with Albert Einstein. "Remember your humanity and forget the rest." But it was the anti-war movement that had taken on more urgency in Buffett's mind after Congress passed the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution in 1964, authorizing President Johnson to use military force in Southeast Asia without formally declaring war, using an alleged but unproven naval attack against a U.S. destroyer as the pretext to attack North Vietnam. Young men were burning their draft cards, going to jail, and fleeing to Canada to avoid the draft. Hundreds of thousands took to the streets all over the world to protest the war escalation. They marched in New York City on Fifth Avenue, in Times Square, and at the New York Stock Exchange. In Tokyo, London, Rome, Philadelphia, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and elsewhere. Warren was not an ideological pacifist like many of those who were marching, nor an extreme isolationist like his father, but he did feel strongly that the war was wrong, and that U.S. involvement in it was based on deception, especially troubling for a man who placed such a high value on honesty. He started asking speakers over to the House to talk to his friends about it. Once he brought an anti-war speaker from as far away as Pennsylvania. He himself, however, was not going to march against the war. Warren had strong views about specialization. He defined his special skills as thinking and making money. When asked to donate, his first choice always was to donate ideas, including ideas that would get other people to give money. But he would also give money himself, not a lot, but some, to politicians and to Susie's causes. He never labored in the trenches stuffing envelopes. Volunteering directly for causes, no matter how urgent and important, would consume time he felt was more efficiently spent thinking of ideas and making more money to write bigger checks. Many people in the 1960s felt a burning desire to tear down the establishment that had created the war and operated the military-industrial complex, a desire to avoid selling out to the man. For some, therefore, social consciousness clashed with the need to make a living. Warren, however, saw himself as working for his partners, not for the man, and as someone whose business acumen and money helped the civil rights and anti-war causes. So he could focus on his business with a sense of dual purpose, and felt no inner conflict about how he spent his time. The conflict he was beginning to feel was a struggle to find investments for the partnership. During the past year, he had put money into safe but increasingly scarce cigar butts like his old favorite Philadelphia and Redding and Consolidation Coal. He had managed to find some of the few undervalued stocks that still paraded through the Standard & Poor's weekly report. Employers Reinsurance, F.W. Woolworth, and First Lincoln Financial. He'd also bought some stock in Disney after meeting Walt Disney and seeing the entertainment showman's singular focus, his love of his work, and the way these had translated into a priceless catalog of entertainment. But the concept of great businesses had not entirely sunk in, and he didn't load up. Of course, he'd continued to cobble together a bigger and bigger stake in Berkshire Hathaway, but he had also built a $7 million short position in stocks like Alcoa, Montgomery Ward, Travelers Insurance, and Caterpillar Tractor, borrowing the shares and selling them as a hedge against the risk that the market would plunge. When investors changed their minds, stocks often dropped like doves thwacked full of birdshot in mid-flight. He wanted the protection for the partner's portfolio. In January 1966, another $6.8 million had rolled in from his partners. Buffett found himself with a $44 million partnership and too few cigar butts to light with his cash. Thus, for the first time, he had set aside some money and left it unused, an extraordinary decision. Ever since the day he left Columbia Business School, his problem had always been getting his hands on enough money to pump into a seemingly endless supply of investment ideas. Then, on February 9, 1966, the Dow had briefly streaked across the mythical 1,000 mark before closing just a few points below. The chant began, Dow 1,000, Dow 1,000. The market would not break through the barrier again that year, but the euphoria carried on anyway. Buffett had been worrying all year about disappointing his partners. Although he started his latest letter to them cheerily with the news about the huge profits on American Express, "Our war on poverty was successful in 1965," he wrote, alluding to President Johnson's program to bring about a great society through a vast array of new social welfare programs. He then delivered the real news in what would be the first of many similar warnings. I now feel that we are much closer to the point where increased size may prove disadvantageous. And with that, he announced that he would be shutting the door to the partnership, locking it, and putting away the key. There would be no more new partners. He made a joke of it. Susie couldn't have any more kids, he wrote, because they wouldn't be allowed in. This joke was not particularly apt, since none of their children had ever actually been partners, or would be. He was determined to manage their expectations about money in order to ensure that they would find their own way in life. From an early age, each of the kids knew not to expect financial help from him except to pay for their education. He could have brought the children into the partnership as a learning exercise, to teach them about money, about investing, and about how he spent his time. Certainly he used it that way with those who were members of the partnership. But Warren rarely, if ever, taught those he saw day to day. For him, teaching was a performance, a conscious act that took place before an audience. His kids got no lessons. Instead, he bought them stock in the benighted Berkshire Hathaway. As trustee of the trust left to his children by his father, he sold the farm that Howard had bought as a refuge for the family and used the money to buy the stock. Given that Warren didn't approve of unearned wealth, which was how he viewed inheritance, he might have left the farm alone. A small farm in Nebraska would never be worth much, and the kids would never become rich from their grandfather's inheritance. But by investing the proceeds in his floundering textile business, he increased his hold on Berkshire by another 2,000 shares. Why he cared so much about it was a mystery to observers, but ever since buffeting his way to control of Berkshire, he seemed obsessed by it. The Buffett kids were not expecting to get rich. They did not even really know that their family was rich. Their parents wanted them to be raised unspoiled, and they were. Like children everywhere, they had to do chores to get their allowances. But when it came to money, their family's odd disconnection meant that Susie and Warren tussled over her allowance as if the Buffetts were broke. Then she got the money anyway and used it to give them an upper-middle-class life. The children went on nice vacations, enjoyed themselves at the country club, wore good clothes, and saw their mother's Cadillac and fur coats. But they never got to take money for granted. Their father niggled over small amounts of money all the time, and he surprised them by denying little requests. If he took them to a movie, he might not pay for popcorn. If one of the kids asked for something, his answer might well be no. If I did it for you, I'd have to do it for everyone. Whatever message he and Susie were trying to give the children about money, one unvarying theme came through. Money was important. They were growing up in a household where it was routinely used as a tool of control. Warren would take Big Susie to a store for her birthday and give her 90 minutes to race through and buy whatever she could grab. The Buffett side of the family had always been about making deals. Although Susie felt that Warren's obsession with making money was unworthy, she still angled to get more of it from him. Now she was struggling with her weight, and this too became a money deal. Warren's childhood obsession with weighing machines, he would have weighed himself 50 times a day, had been no passing phase. He was obsessed with his family's weight and preoccupied with keeping them all thin. The family's eating habits helped neither his cause nor their health. Susie, who had suffered from a mysterious and excruciating abdominal adhesion 2 years before, cooked unenthusiastically. She and Warren both willingly ate the same thing day after day, mostly meat and potatoes. Unlike Warren, Susie would eat vegetables, but she refused every fruit except watermelon. She picked at healthy food while living on chocolate and Rice Krispies treats, frosting out of a can, cookies, Tootsie Rolls, and milk, milk, milk. Warren breakfasted on Fritos and Pepsi, ate handfuls of chocolate and popcorn, and chose steaks, hamburgers, and the odd sandwich as his mainstay meals. Finally, Susie asked him to make a deal to pay her to keep her weight at 118 pounds. Since she cared less about money than her husband did, however, motivation was a problem for her. All month long, she picked and snacked, but then, as the weigh-in date approached, she would get on the scale. If the news was bad and she had to take the pounds off fast, "Uh-oh," she'd say to one of Susie Jr.'s friends, "Kelsey, I've got to call your mom for her diuretic pills." Warren disciplined himself to maintain his own weight by dangling money in front of his kids. When they were younger, He made out unsigned checks to them for $10,000 and said that if he didn't weigh 173 pounds on such and such a date, he would sign the checks. Little Susie and Howie went crazy trying to tempt him with ice cream and chocolate cake, but the prospect of giving up money pained Warren far more than giving up a treat. He made out those checks over and over, but he never had to sign a single one. Instead of his children, one of the last new partners Warren allowed to join his partnership was Marshall Weinberg, a stockbroker friend of Walter Schloss, who had taken Graham's seminar twice. A cultivated man with a bent for the arts and philosophy, Weinberg had met Buffett at one of Graham's lectures at the New School in New York. Lunching together a few times and talking of stocks, they had become friends. Weinberg soon gave up on interesting Buffett in music, art, philosophy, or travel, but Buffett traded through him at times, and Weinberg became interested in joining the partnership. So on one of the Buffett's frequent trips to New York, Warren agreed to meet with him to discuss it. Loping downstairs from his room at the plaza, Warren met Weinberg in the lobby. Then Susie glided in, and Warren lit up. She sidled over to him and gave him a hug, then put her hand behind him as if he were a child and gazed at Weinberg with her large brown eyes. "How are you?" she asked, beaming at him. She wanted to know everything about him. He felt he was being welcomed into a family and went away thinking that he had made a new friend in Susie. He also intuited that he had just met Buffett's most powerful asset. Weinberg had squeaked through the door just in time. Through 1966, the urban riots continued, the war in Vietnam escalated, and anti-war protesters rallied in New York, Boston, Philadelphia, Chicago, Washington, and San Francisco. The stock market began to decline, down 10% from the beginning of the year. Buffett had never stopped looking for things to buy, no matter how uphill the climb, but despite the market's easing, the days of cigar butts scattered everywhere were gone. He became seriously worried about how to keep up his performance. He thought more often of buying entire businesses now. In fact, he had gotten started on an entirely new venture, one that consumed large amounts of his time. Chapter 29. What a Worsted Is. Omaha, 1966 to 1967. Buffett ran a $50 million partnership that owned a textile business, yet he had never stopped looking like the raggedy man. His only concession to the sideburns and long hair that other men wore was a little patch of fine dark hairs that he occasionally let sprout from his crew cut like baby grass over his domed forehead. The rest of the world was turning mod. Men wore Nehru jackets, turtlenecks, and wide geometric and floral patterned ties. Buffett never varied his skinny striped ties and white shirt, though the shirt's collar had grown tighter and the jacket of the old gray suit he wore day after day bunched around his shoulders and gaped at the neckline. He refused to part with his favorite camel-colored V-neck sweater, although its elbows had grown thin. His shoes had holes in the soles. When Chuck Peterson tried to introduce him to a potential investor at a party, the man's reaction had been, "You're kidding." He didn't even want to talk to Buffett, based purely on the way Warren dressed. Susie had no influence. Her husband's taste had formed back in 1949 when he was selling suits at J.C. Penney's, and Mr. Lanford told him that nobody knows what a worsted is. He now bought his suits at Parso's, downstairs in the lobby of Kiewit Plaza, where Sol Parso was always trying to upgrade his taste. Buffett considered Parso a very wild dresser and paid no attention to his suggestions. Warren's idea of a proper suit was one that you could bury a 90-year-old banker from a small town in western Nebraska in. Parso prided himself on giving Buffett good advice about stocks, however. He had steered him away from hatter Byer Rolnick, warning that hats were going out of style. He had also kept him from investing in Oxford clothes, delivering the news that suits were not a growth business in the 1960s. Buffett, however, had ignored Parso's warning not to buy suit lining maker Berkshire Hathaway. Since he knew nothing about clothing, why the next episode of his career would consist of buying a department store remained somewhat mysterious. It took a whopper of an idea to crack open his wallet these days, but in 1966, He was having trouble finding things to buy for the partnership. It was one of his newer friends, David Sandy Gottesman, who brought him this latest idea. Gottesman was like Fred Stanback, Bill Ruane, Dan Cohen, Tom Knapp, Henry Brandt, Ed Anderson, and Charlie Munger, people who worked their own ideas and fed ideas to him. The ever-handy Ruane had connected them at a lunch in New York City. Gottesman, a fellow Harvard graduate from a different year, worked for a small investment bank and sometimes found the odd cigar butt or two. Buffett considered him a shrewd, disciplined, hard-nosed, opinionated, unabashed capitalist. Naturally, they hit it off. "From then on," says Gottesman, "every time I had a good idea, I would call Warren. It was like vetting. If you could get Warren interested in something, you knew that you had the right idea." The quintessential New Yorker, Gottesman valued his time with Buffett highly enough to be willing to travel to Omaha often. "We'd stay up till late at night talking about stocks," he says, "and then I'd go back the next morning and go to work in New York. We also talked every Sunday night at around 10 o'clock for maybe an hour and a half about stocks. I was looking forward to that conversation all week, thinking about what are the stocks I'm going to talk to him about. No matter what I talked to him about, he knew as much as I did about them most of the time. After I hung up," says Gottesman, "I used to go to bed around midnight or afterward, and I couldn't go to sleep for a couple of hours, I was so charged up." In January 1966, Gottesman had brought Buffett an idea. Hochschild Cohn, a venerable department store headquartered in a building a city block in size that sat at an intersection in downtown Baltimore. Although it was kitty-corner to three competitors, Hutzler's, Hecht Company, and Stewart's, all four stores had prospered since the times when ladies donned hats and gloves and rode the streetcar downtown to spend all day shopping and having lunch. The well-regarded Hochschild Cohn sold apparel, home furnishings, and housewares. Its proprietors, the Cohn family, drove old cars and lived modestly, just the kind of people Buffett liked. Martin Cohn, the company's CEO, had called Gottesman to tell him that several branches of the family were thinking of selling and would probably accept a discount price. "The Cohns took enormous pride in this store," says Gottesman, "but if it had a good dress department, they never bought a dress there. It was too expensive for them." When Charlie Munger was in Omaha, he, Buffett, and Gottesman usually played a lot of golf, and they'd sit at the grill at the Omaha Country Club drinking pitchers of iced tea, talking stocks, and kidding around. But although they liked the same kind of stocks, the three had never partnered on a deal. This time, Gottesman called Buffett and told him the part about Hochschild Cohn's discount price and the Cohns' parsimony, and Buffett got hooked. He owned no other retailing stock besides a little F.W. Woolworth. Department stores rose and fell on fashion and customer tastes. He knew as much about that as how to bake a souffle. He wanted Munger to tap into his incisive way of sizing up businesses. The two of them flew to Baltimore and liked the Cohns immediately. They were the soul of integrity, reliable people with connections all over town. After the episodes with Lee Diamond at Dempster and Seabury Stanton at Berkshire, Buffett knew that if he were to buy a company, he needed a manager he could count on to run the business for him. He felt that Lewis Cohn was that man. Cohn had a financial background and understood the numbers and profit margins well. Buffett had become confident of his ability to assess people quickly after experience with bringing in 300 partners and meeting countless business executives over the years. The two men looked at the balance sheet and made a $12 million bid on the spot. Munger did the negotiating with Lewis Cohn's relative Martin, the outgoing CEO, whom he considered this wonderful old guy who headed the place. He told Martin Cohn, "I came in here and I saw a lot of old women with swollen ankles standing behind your perfume counter with unfunded pension liabilities. Do you really want to sell this business, which is the work of your life, to somebody who might worry you about their pensions? Don't you want to take care of your own?" Cohn tossed the towel into Munger's lap so fast that Charlie could barely catch it. On January 30th, 1966, Buffett, Munger, and Gottesman formed a holding company, Diversified Retailing Company Incorporated, to acquire diversified businesses, especially in the retail field. Buffett owned 80% of DRC. Gottesman and Munger each took 10%. Buffett and Munger then went to the Maryland National Bank and asked for a loan to make the purchase. The lending officer looked at them goggle-eyed and exclaimed, $6 million for little old Hochschild Cohn? Even after hearing this, Buffett and Munger, characteristically, did not question their own judgment and run screaming out the door. We thought we were buying a second-class department store at a third-class price, is how Buffett describes little old Hochschild Cohn. He had never borrowed any significant money to buy a company, but they figured the margin of safety reduced their risk, and interest rates were cheap at the time. Profits in department stores were thin, but as those profits grew over the years, the interest on the debt would stay the same, and any increase in the profits would flow to themselves, if the profits grew over the years. Buying Hochschild Cohn was like the story of a man who buys a yacht, says Munger. The two happy days are the day he buys it and the day he sells it. Louis Cohn and Sandy Gottesman flew out to Laguna Beach, where the Buffetts were renting a house, and holed up in a nearby motel. Buffett strategized with Cohn and Gottesman. He was already becoming fond of Louis Cohn. He was as high-grade a guy that you could ever imagine, had an IQ way up there, very decent guy, and he came into the partnership when we bought Hochschild Cohn. I loved the guy. The Cohns were another couple for him and Susie to socialize with, meaning that he and Cohn could talk business while Susie entertained Cohn's wife. The Buffett social life by now included a significant number of people who lived outside of Omaha, people they usually saw on one of Warren's business trips, or, as now, when friends visited the Buffetts in California. But Buffett began to grow concerned on his next trip to Baltimore when Cohn showed him a plan the company had been developing for some time to build two new stores, one in York, Pennsylvania, the other in Maryland. The idea was to capitalize on the exodus from city to suburb that was sending people to suburban shopping malls. They'd been planning those two stores for a couple of years. The guy that had the men's furnishings department had his section laid out. He knew exactly how he was going to decorate it. The woman who ran the high-priced dress department had hers all planned, too. Buffett didn't like confrontation and dreaded disappointing people, but he and Charlie agreed that neither of these locations made sense. He spiked the York store, and the Hochschild Cohn employees and management resisted. Lacking the stomach for a fight, Warren gave in. But he drew the line at the Columbia, Maryland store. I ended up killing that, and everybody died. They just died. Then more signs of trouble arrived in the form of numbers coming from Baltimore, revealing that every time one of the four department stores downtown put in an elevator, the other three had to do the same. Every time one store upgraded its window displays or bought new cash register systems, the others had to follow suit. Buffett and Munger came to call this standing on tiptoe at a parade. Once anybody did it, everybody had to do it. Still, for the first time, Buffett and Munger had found something they could partner on. Through diversified retailing, they and Gottesman had, in effect, created a separate company specifically to own retailers. But Hochschild Cohn was the beginning of a pattern that would recur more than once in frothy markets. Buffett had lowered his standards to justify an investment. That he had done it at a time when he was having more and more trouble finding what he considered to be good investments in the stock market was no coincidence. In this case, we were enough influenced by the Graham ethos, says Munger, that we thought if you just got enough assets for your dollars, somehow you could make it work out. And we didn't weigh heavily enough the intense competition between four different department stores in Baltimore at a time when department stores no longer had an automatic edge. Within the first couple of years at Hochschild Cohn, Buffett had figured out that the essential skill in retailing was merchandising, not finance. He and his partners also had learned enough about retailing to understand that it was a lot like the restaurant business, a wearying marathon in which, every mile, fresh, aggressive competition could leap in and race ahead of you. When the three had an opportunity to acquire another retailer through DRC, this one very different and run by a true merchandiser, they went ahead, however. This retailer came to them through Will Felsteiner, the lawyer who had also worked on the Hochschild Cohn deal, who called to say, if you're interested in retailing, here's the numbers on Associated Cotton Shops. The cotton shop sold women's dresses. Here, Buffett was headed even further afield from his basic circle of competence, although this next episode would bring into his fold one of the all-time greatest managers and characters he would ever meet in his life. A cheap little scroungy is how Munger described Associated Retail Stores, the parent of the cotton shops. Seeing a set of third-class stores for a fourth-class price, he and Buffett were immediately interested. Associated owned 80 stores with $44 million of sales and earned a couple of million dollars a year. Benjamin Rosner, its 63-year-old proprietor, ran discount dress shops in tough neighborhoods in cities such as Chicago, Buffalo, New York, and Gary, Indiana, under names like Fashion Outlet, Gay Time, and York. Sometimes he installed several tiny stores carrying the same goods under different names on the same city block. They ranged in size from that of a modest New York City apartment to a well-appointed suburban house. Rosner kept the overhead microscopic and sold only for cash. Running these outlets required unusual skills. In Chicago, a manager at the Milwaukee Avenue store, a big, hard-boiled woman, blew a whistle every time she saw somebody come in that she knew was a shoplifter type. All the employees would look over and watch the guy from then on. She knew them all and had the lowest shrinkage rate of practically any store you could ever find in the toughest neighborhood you could imagine. Inventory shrinkage is just what it sounds like. Inventory that is unaccounted for, usually because of shoplifting or employee theft. Born in 1904 to Austro-Hungarian immigrants, Ben Rosner dropped out of school in the fourth grade. In 1931, the downdraft of the Great Depression, he started with one little store on the north side of Chicago, $3,200 in capital, a partner, Leo Simon, and a batch of dresses they sold for $2.88 apiece. When Simon died in the mid-1960s, more than three decades later, Rosner continued to pay his widow, A. Simon, daughter of communications mogul Moses Annenberg, Leo's salary in exchange for the nominal task of signing the rent checks for their 80 stores. This went on for about 6 months, and then she started complaining and second-guessing and criticizing, and that really got to Ben. She was a spoiled, spoiled, spoiled woman. Now, Ben was a guy whose principle, as he later explained to me, was to screw everybody except his partner. And in his mind, she's no longer his partner. So he decided that he had to end this whole thing. So as the switch flips in his mind, he's going to screw her. He decided that he was going to sell the business to me too cheap, even though he owns half of it, because it'll show her. When we met with him, he started talking, and I got the picture very quickly. Buffett had been there before with people who were talking themselves into thinking they were better off without something, and he knew not to do anything that would interfere. He's talking about selling his business that he's built up all his life, and he's going crazy because he can't stand it, and he can't stand her. He's just a total mess. So Charlie goes back in the room with me, and after about half an hour, Ben was jumping up and down, and he said, "They told me you were the fastest gun in the West. Draw." And I said, "I'll draw on you before I leave this afternoon." Buffett needed a manager, but Rosner told him that he would stay only until the end of the year, then turn the business over to the new owners. Buffett could see, however, that just as the business couldn't carry on without Rosner, fortunately, Rosner couldn't carry on without the business. He loved it too much to quit. He kept a duplicate set of store records in the bathroom so that he could look at them while he was sitting on the can. He had this rival, Milton Petry of Petry Stores. One time, Ben went to a big bash at the Waldorf. Milton's there. They immediately started talking business. Ben said, "How much do you pay for light bulbs? How much do you mark up?" And that's all Ben could talk about. Finally, he said to Milton, "How much are you paying for toilet paper?" And Milton said, "So much." Ben was buying his quite a bit cheaper, and he knew that you want to be not just cheaper, but right. Milton said, "Yeah, that's the best I can get." And Ben said, "Excuse me." And he got up, left the black tie benefit, drove out to his warehouse in Long Island, and started tearing open cartons of toilet paper and counting the sheets because he was suspicious. He knew that Milton could not be paying too much by that wide a margin, and therefore that he must be getting screwed himself somehow on toilet paper. And sure enough, the vendors were saying that there were 500 sheets per roll on one of these things, and there weren't. He was getting screwed on toilet paper. Buffett knew that he wanted to be in business with the kind of guy who would leave a black tie party to count sheets of toilet paper, a guy who might screw the guy across the table, but never his own partner. He made a deal with Rosner for $6 million. To make sure that Rosner would stay on the job after he bought the business, he flattered Rosner, made certain he got the numbers to evaluate its performance, and otherwise left him alone. Buffett felt at one with the Ben Rosners of the world. He saw in their relentlessness the spirit of success. He was sick of problem companies like Hochschild Kone and was looking for more Ben Rosners, people who had built excellent businesses that he could buy. He and Rosner shared a mutual obsession. As Buffett liked to put it, intensity is the price of excellence. Chapter 30. Jet Jack. Omaha, 1967. As late as 1967, Susie seemed to think that Warren would be more attentive to her and the family if he quit working. In her mind, the two of them had an understanding that they would scale back their lives once he made $8 or $10 million. His 1966 fees of $1.5 million and gains on his capital brought the family's net worth to over $9 million. She badgered him that the time had come. But Warren's pace never slackened as he shifted his focus from one preoccupation to another, raising money for the partnerships, buying National American, Sanborn Map, Dempster, Berkshire Hathaway, Hochschild Kone, American Express, and any number of investments in between. Sometimes his back seized up when he got on a plane, and occasionally Susie had to nurse him for several days while he was bedridden with pain. His doctor couldn't find any specific cause, suggesting that work or stress might have something to do with it. But Warren was about as likely to stop working for the sake of his back as he was to fork down a big plate of broccoli for the sake of his health. He was always sitting hunched over something, a book, the phone, a bridge or poker game with friends like Dick Holland and Nick Newman, a prominent businessman who owned Hinky Dinky, the same grocery chain from which Warren had slunk, humiliated as a boy after his grandfather sent him to buy loaves of bread. Newman and his wife were active in the community and in civil rights circles, and, like the low-key Hollands, they were typical of the Buffett's friends. Warren and Susie stayed away from the Omaha social circuit. Their joint social life was evolving into a series of recurring events that followed the rhythm of Warren's work and often took place when they were traveling to see Warren's friends. In town, however, Susie stayed on call. She shuttled between her own friends, family, needy cases, and community work. A sign now hung on the Buffett's unlocked back door that read, "The doctor is in." One or another of Susie's patients could often be found wandering around the house. Her clientele came from all different ages and stations in life, and some were more demanding than others. They asked, and Susie gave, and when they asked for more, she gave more. When Susie asked, Warren gave, and when Susie asked for more, Warren complied. Unyielding about how he spent his time, he gave in to her on almost everything else. This was the year they remodeled the house. Already the biggest on the block, under Susie's direction, a new wing replaced the old garage, giving the neighborhood kids a place to gather in a new family room. Warren was excited at having his own racquetball court in the basement underneath, like ping pong on a human-size scale, where he took his friends and business colleagues to play. But even though Warren was like a kid in many ways, and Susie wished he were a more attentive father, he was loyal and committed. He showed up at school events and took the children on vacations. And while 1967, the year of White Rabbit and Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, marked the apex of the rock and roll drug culture, with Susie Jr. in eighth grade, Howie in sixth, and Peter in third, the Buffetts were blessedly free of worries faced by many other parents. Susie Jr. had developed from a timid child to a self-sufficient teen and the undisputed boss of her siblings. While her mother filled the house with ballads and soul music when she sang and played albums, little Suze had turned into a rock and roll girl. She introduced her brothers to groups like the Byrds and the Kinks. She was a straight kid, however, not sucked into the druggy element at school. Howie, now 12, was still young enough to try to scare his sister and her friends by looming from the crabapple tree outside her window in a gorilla costume, but his pranks were getting more sophisticated and more dangerous. He put Scout the dog on the roof, went downstairs, and called him to see if he would come. Scout did, and wound up at the vet with a broken leg. "Well, I just wanted to see if he would come," Howie protested. To foil his mother from periodically locking him in his room out of frustration, he bought a lock at a hardware store and started locking her out. Peter spent hours at the piano, playing by himself or with his friend Lars Eriksson. He was winning talent shows and seemed as absorbed in his music as his father was in making money. The one person in the family who was seduced by the dark side of the psychedelic 60s was 17-year-old Billy Rogers, son of Susie's sister Dottie, now a budding jazz guitarist who was experimenting with drugs. His mother did some volunteer work and was an expert seamstress, but she also slept until noon, seemed paralyzed by making decisions, and at times was so distant and vague that it was literally impossible to carry on a coherent conversation with her. Dottie was drinking more and not paying attention to her kids. Susie often took Billy to watch Calvin Keyes, a local jazz guitar player, so that Billy could learn technique from him, but also to try to straighten Billy out. She faced a daunting task in an era when the drug culture of pot and LSD was ubiquitous, and Timothy Leary invited America to turn on, tune in, drop out. The youth-led counterculture was rebelling against all forms of authority, everything for which the prior decades had stood. "This ain't Eisenhower's America no more," said one of the 100,000 hippies milling about San Francisco's Haight-Ashbury that summer, as if that were explanation enough. Warren still lived in Eisenhower's America. He had never suffered from Beatlemania. He wasn't singing Kumbaya or putting up posters saying that war was unhealthy for children and other living things. His state of consciousness remained unaltered. His mind was deep in rigorous philosophical inquiry, torn between the cigar butt philosophy of Ben Graham and the great businesses of Phil Fisher and Charlie Munger. "I was in this Charlie Munger influence type transition, sort of back and forth. It was kind of like during the Protestant Reformation, and I would listen to Martin Luther one day and the Pope the next. Ben Graham, of course, being the Pope." While Munger was nailing his theses on the door of the Cigar Butt Cathedral, the market itself had abandoned all authorities past and present. As the 1960s progressed, chatter about stocks enlivened cocktail parties, and housewives called their brokers from the beauty parlor. Trading volumes were up by one-third. Buffett, at 36, felt like a grizzled old man in a world that craved Transitron, Polaroid, Xerox, electronic data systems, companies whose technology he did not understand. He told his partners that he was slowing down. "We simply don't have that many good ideas," he wrote. Yet he did not relax his rules in search of ways to keep the money at work. Instead, he laid out two new restrictions that would make it even harder for him to invest. These personal preferences now became part of the official canon. Number one, we will not go into businesses where technology, which is way over my head, is crucial to the investment decision. I know about as much about semiconductors or integrated circuits as I do of the mating habits of the Chersazags. Number two, we will not seek out activity in investment operations, even if offering splendid profit expectations, where major human problems appear to have a substantial chance of developing. By major human problems, he meant layoffs, plant closings, and union businesses that couldn't take a strike. This also meant he would think once, twice, three times before smoking any more cigar butts. The cigar butts he owned were problem enough. Berkshire Hathaway was now on life support. Buffett had recently hired his Pete Marwick auditor, Vern McKenzie, and sent him off to New Bedford to oversee the wretched textile mill. He had been regretting a mistake he had made at a recent Berkshire Hathaway board meeting. Feeling flush during what would turn out to be a brief moment of financial success, "We were selling out of rayon linings for a few months and making a lot of money," Buffett had let himself get talked into a 10-cent per share dividend. The firm's lawyers had argued that Berkshire was doing so well that it might be accused of unjustifiably retaining earnings. Either while daydreaming or simply in a moment of weakness, Buffett went along with the distribution. A dime a share sounded measly. It somehow took him 24 hours to realize the fallacy of their argument. By then it was too late, and his uncharacteristic agreeableness had showered on the partners and shareholders $101,733 that he knew he could have turned into millions someday. He would never make a mistake like that again.